When the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain. And you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Laren Young, and thanks for checking out the Green Chain Podcast. Betty Krasik is one of Canada's most famous and unrepentant jailbirds. Betty was first arrested on the blockades at Clackwood Sound. Since then, she spent more than 3.5 years in jail, serving 8 different sentences. And she has no plans to slow down her fight. She's currently working on a new book, Are You Crazy, Lady? I met Betty at her home in Vancouver to talk about why she's willing to go to jail for trees.
How did you get involved in the environmental movement?
Well, when we came to Canada, the pressures of the move and just the uncertainty, the different way of living. My husband and I got a divorce, and I got involved with the women's movement, particularly through my daughters. You know, bringing home books that were really quite sexist in those days. And one daughter came home, they had no coach for a ball team, but they had a coach for the boys ball team, and she couldn't play on the boys ball team. And so it just, one thing led to another, where I became a part of the movement in Sarnia, Ontario. I married a Canadian, and that marriage also disintegrated. I moved, but we had come out to the to British Columbia when we first met, and I had seen British Columbia, and I just don't believe that anybody who sees this West Coast, particularly Vancouver Island, up around the Clackwood Sound, I just totally became enamored of this province and all of British Columbia. So we had to go back to Ontario, but when that marriage also disintegrated, I knew that I wanted to live myself in British Columbia. So all of the girls came with me out here, and after they were all settled in school, we stayed for a couple of years in Victoria until they entered university. And then when they were all in university or all married and working, I bought 10 acres in the Clackwood Sound on a place called Cypress Bay. And one of my sons built an A-frame for me. And it was the most wonderful experience. I went out there, and I lived out there for 3 years. But the beauty of the place struck me to the heart, that it was being demolished by the way the logging companies were just absolutely clear-cutting everything in sight. And as I went back, navigated back in through the sound to see some of these more remote places where the clear cutting was just crazy, you could see that whole mountainsides were sort of washing down into the sea from soil disintegration. And the 10 acres that I had bought, it was old growth. There had been some selective logging through there, but it was primarily old growth. But as I became acquainted with the mountain, the huge mountain behind the place, I saw that what looked green from a distance up close, it's not really trees, it's shrubs. It's scrub brush. And during the winters, when the heavy rains came, that scrub brush didn't hold that mountainside in place. It all slid down, and part of it was coming down around my place. And I got up one morning and went out, and there was this humongous landslide sitting on beach on the cove, covering almost all of the cove, certainly covering the creek where I got my water, the stream. And I looked at that and I thought, this is outrageous. This is absolutely outrageous. They're just killing the earth with this clear cutting. And the water, the debris was washing into the streams. These were fish bearing streams, that were just being demolished by the greed of logging companies. So I would complain. I went to Tofino and complained, which did no good to the forestry and to the fisheries. No response. Then I went down to Victoria and complained. Still no response. There was a group in Tofino called the Friends of Clockwood Sound, and I had been stopping in and giving them bits of money from time to time. But now I knew it was going to take more than that, that all of the issues that I had worked on before and written about and thought about and researched, they were all predicated on a reasonably healthy earth. If you don't have a healthy earth, you don't have anything. Everything else it's as though it might not even exist. Without the earth being healthy, nothing is healthy. Nothing will live. So I became convinced that all of these other issues had their origin in the way the earth was thought of and the way the earth was treated. So I made a commitment at that point to the environment, as my friend Berta says, a total commitment. And so the night before that I went out to the blockade in the summer of 1993, I stayed up all night making sure that I would be able psychologically to honor this commitment wherever it may bring, because I'd never been arrested before and I was fearful of being claustrophobic and I worried about that. I worried about making ass out of myself. Okay. And what if I was the only one to be arrested, because I didn't know if anybody was going to be arrested. It was the first day of the blockade. So I stayed up all night. I didn't sleep at all. And by the morning's light, I had made peace with it, that even if I made a fool of myself or if I was imprisoned, that's okay.
Were you the oldest person there?
Oh, yes, I'm always the oldest person anywhere. I'll be 80 in August, you know. So, but there were two other grandmothers. They were younger than I, but Judith Robertson, wait a minute, Judith Robertson may have been somewhat older than me. I've forgotten how old Judith Robertson was. Okay. She was either a few years older or a few years younger. And then the other grandmother was quite a bit younger. So I found that I could stay in jail just fine. You know, that people have, I have an active inner life that I can retreat to when the outside becomes raucous on the nervous system. Well, as a writer, you know how that goes. You can retreat to your own places, imaginary or otherwise.
How did the other protesters treat you, and how did the police treat you the first day when you got arrested?
They were good. Cameras were on them. You know, no policeman wants to be accused of throwing around the fragile bones of grandmas. So they were careful, and it was fine. And then we were sent to, the three of us refused to sign the undertaking to say that we were sorry or that we would be good. So we were sent to the men's prison in Nanaimo, Brandon Lake, and in a special kind of unit. So thus began our prison terms. But looking back on this, that actually was very soft treatment compared to what I've endured in the women's prisons on long terms.
Really?
Yes, because there were so many of us that were arrested in the Clackwood Sound. It was a new thing. They brought over, because so many of us were vegetarians, they brought over just boxes of vegetables and oils and stuff and let people cook their own stuff. And it was pretty easy. And we were allowed to talk to the press. My last stint in the Alouette Prison for Women, hugely different. Gordon Campbell has privatized the services in the prison so that you're confined a lot more. You have to buy everything from their canteen, which is overpriced. You're paid $2.50 a day, $2.50 to $4.50 a day within that range, and yet you have to buy these expensive things from the canteen. And a local phone call that would cost a normal person a quarter, if you're a prisoner, it's 90 cents, that kind of thing. Food is horrible. There are very few programs to speak of that are beneficial for the women. They try to make money out of the women. It's what they do. They try to make women go to work for private firms. You know, it's prison labor that they're using for private firms. So it just, the women are exploited whichever way they turn. There has always been an uneasy balance in the prisons between rehabilitation and punishment. In the women's prison in Burnaby, before it closed down and I was there, the open living unit, which I have just written this book about, was actually trying to help the women become rehabilitated. But Gordon Campbell closed that unit down, closed that prison down for women, and now at Alouette, it's all punishment.
I got the impression you became something of like a den mother and mentor when you were in Burnaby.
Yes, I did. Because these women have such multiple problems that they... What I did do, because these women are faceless to the, here's a copy of my latest book. It's about the open living unit, is that the women are faceless to the general public. The general public has no idea who the women are in prison. So I did a series of interviews and snuck them out of the prison on the prisoners. And they were on my blog for a long time. I've not taken them off because one of the women called me and said that she would like it taken off because she was trying to get a kind of a job where they would do, she was trying to downplay her prison. Anyway, I took them all off in case some of them, others didn't particularly like them being on there when they get out. So, but... I did. I tried to help them with their legal problems and with their just general problems of living because some of them are poorly educated, really poorly educated, and have problems with doing kind of simple procedures of living if you are on the outside. This is why it's so disgusting that this government cuts back on prison services when they should just be putting a whole lot of money into it. The more women who can come out and actually connect with the society and get a job and start living, and I would say normal, but what the heck is normal these days? You know, a normal life is a psychotic life in many ways, but at least stay out of jail. But instead, they make sure that the women are going to come back into jail. They're building a prison industry, is what it amounts to. And it's so disgusting.
The impression that I got from watching you on the news and reading various stories about you is that, if anything, prison strengthened your resolve.
It did, and it does still. And I'm not finished yet. Really, there, we were just discussing this the other night, some other activists. It's just too crazy what's happening to the world. And it does strengthen my resolve, because what happens is that I've been through the worst that they can do to me and survived it, and I'm not afraid of it. And when you're not afraid of the worst that they can do to you, then you have a power that they don't like, you know, that rattles them. But the thing about crime is that we need a redefinition of crime. Crime is when a government steals the public assets and uses them to their personal advantage. Now, that's a crime. That's a crime. And yet, Gordon Campbell's government does it all the time. And this gutless mayor and council go along with it. That's a crime to do that. It's a crime to allow the natural resources of this province that belong to everybody be confiscated by a few people who destroy them for their own profit. That's a crime. Those are the two huge crimes that we are having to face as citizens. But they keep us looking at crimes that they also create. Our terrorists is our government. Gordon Campbell's government and cabinet, they're terrorists. They're terrorizing the people of British Columbia. And we have to become terrorist warriors, in that if we're going to have a decent life, we're going to eventually have to face these governmental terrorists.
Now, why, this leads into something that I have to ask, why have you opted for civil disobedience so many times, as opposed to like what you're doing now, which is running for mayor?
Well, I haven't, they go hand in hand. The battle has to be fought on both fronts. If you look back at some of the historical revolutions, they are fought on both fronts. There's always two pushes. So one is activism, and the other is people who support activism. And they're not mutually exclusive. Trying to get into government is a support of activists. Activism, it's activism in itself, in that you're looking for a social revolution. And that, in terms of facing entrenched bureaucracy, and then facing a social and economic system that has all the power, and then it has all the money to even face this, is activism. So it has to be fought on all fronts. And but I disagree that money is the criteria for social change. It's not. It's people. It's determination to bring about social change. That is always the criteria. You have to have that. You have to have people committed to social change for it to come, for it to happen. But it happens when people don't see any way out. Nobody likes change. Change brings a furor, you know, it uproars. It brings uncertainty. It brings anxiety. But it's when living under a system that brings more uncertainty and more anxiety and more furor than combating it, then there will be a change. When women see that their children may not live to grow up because of the ways in which the government have allowed corporations to bring pollutants out into the social system without adequate safeguards because of pressure and lobbyists for chemical companies, for product companies, for just things like baby bottles, plastic bottles having compounds in them that bring cancer and that also affect reproductive systems. When people get truly alarmed about the chemical soup that we're living in and the fact that our fish are dying and that animals of species are disappearing all the time, there's a point where people won't take it anymore. And I think it's important for people who do have a vision for what society could be and a feeling for a kind of a transformation into that society. It's their duty to get out there. And whether they're listened to or not, it doesn't matter. Being 80 years old is an advantage in many ways because I can remember back when economic systems failed and pretended social change. I can remember back when in China inflation was so huge that a male correspondent that I was reading said he had to pay his hotel bill every hour because the rate of inflation was jumping every hour. And that was the fall of the China's dynasties. Was an economic thing, was a thing where so few people had all the money and there was no way people could exchange or things became untenable.
How do you think the Clackfoot blockade changed things?
Well, for one thing, it became a biosphere reserve. But that's actually not the main thing. They're looking now at wanting to go into one of the pristine watersheds and log because the First Nations people there are quite on side with logging companies and have always been. A lot of First Nations people are sucked into these agreements, you know, that... and they're poor. They have been poor, so they will take what the logging companies have to give. I don't want to comment on what I think of this, but nevertheless, it's not finished yet in the Clackfoot Sound. But one thing it did do was bring to worldwide attention the determination of these logging companies to just cut down everything they could possibly cut down. I can remember arguing with people with loggers in the Iloho when we were blockading there about Interfor. And I remember this one logger saying, "Why do you keep saying Interfor does this or Interfor does that?" He said, "We are Interfor. Well, now they know they are not Innifor. Innifor cuts and runs they've always done. And now they don't even have their union. The IWA isn't even there anymore because the logging companies managed to kill their union too, along with help from the government. So working people have got it both ways, from having hits from just simply running out of wood, so they move on, the companies move on to greener pastures, so to speak, and they've lost their union. They've got to get smarter than that. People have to get smarter than what they have exhibited in the past, in that we all have to learn from our mistakes, and I've certainly had to learn from mine. And the union just went down the drain because there were no longer enough people working in the forestry to keep it going. And it wasn't from anything that environmentalists did or didn't do. It was from mechanization in the forest and in the mills and in governments, in a provincial government that doesn't care tiddly squat about the people of this province. What they care about is their ideology of the only way to run anything is by privatizing everything, and that they are determined to privatize every public natural asset in this province. They're damming our rivers as we speak here. So the Clackwood Sound was a pretty thing in a sense. Did it change anything? No. Except for the worse. It changed everything for the worse, because then people think, oh, well, everything's okay. It's going to be a biosphere. You know, things are settling down in British Columbia. Things are not settling down in British Columbia. They're cutting all over the bloody place. What they're doing is taking public land with trees on it, with forests, declaring it private land, cutting the trees, and then selling the land to developers. This is what's happening. But they're going to be, in my opinion, in for a very rude shock. And that is, you cannot continue to lower people's buying power, which is what Gordon Campbell has systematically done through their policies of minimum wage, through their policies of busting unions. They have consistently lowered people's buying power while at the same time upping production in some areas. You know, they're depending everything is on mining, is going to be on the last of the logging, on the water. They're just selling out everything in British Columbia. The land, the water, the trees, they're selling it. Out from under our noses. These loggers, I tried to tell them years ago, look, if you guys would petition the government and tell the government you're going to do this, and by God, stick by it and stand on a blockade. You've got a union. Say you want community logging practices, that you want to start having communities in charge of tracts of forest and do selective logging. Oh, no, they're brainwashed into thinking that there will be no logging unless some huge multinational, preferably American company, comes and does it and hires them. Otherwise, they have no notion of trying to take possession of a resource that is theirs to start with, it belongs to all of us, and petition for the right to manage it in a selective way, everybody would still be working in the forest if it was selective logging.
How do you feel about trees?
Well, let me see. How do I feel about trees? I've always loved trees. I was raised in a swamp, you know, in southern Louisiana, cypress trees and oak trees and what they call a live oak tree who stays green all year round. And as children, we played in the wooded and swampy areas. So I grew up feeling kin to the natural world. Out of Clackwood Sound, because I spent 3 years out there by myself, mostly. My children would come for various visits, but I was largely by myself. And I became acquainted with individual trees. There were two trees that lined the banks in front of my cabin. One was the oak, and one was hemlock, and they bothered me because their shadow cast right on the plot of land I was trying to cultivate for a garden. So we had this constant dialogue back and forth. I would keep threatening them and saying that, you know, you're old, you've lived here a long time. They were both really old. I said, maybe it's time for you to go so I can have a garden. And my son would come out and he'd say, Mom, why don't you let me cut down those two trees and then you can have your garden. And the cedar wasn't that old, I don't think. It wasn't as old as the hemlock, but they were both ancient. And I would say, okay, cut them down. But then I'd immediately change my mind. And I'd go out, you know, and try to struggle with putting a garden in between little places where they didn't shade it and it wouldn't work out and the slugs ate everything. And then I'd get mad and tell them I'm really going to cut them down because they're not being very helpful. And so we carried on this dialogue, but I never cut them down. But primarily, trees for me are families. When you see an individual tree standing alone, I always feel sorry for it because it's separated from its family. And this is why a forest presents such an enormous thrill to people when they go into a real forest. They don't know exactly the composition of the thrill that they feel. And it's even in the breathing, you know, the air of forest is very different. But it's because you're in the midst of a thriving ecosystem, which is composed of families. And when I give talks in the school, I tell the little kids this, which sometimes really bothers the teachers. They start getting alarmed. But I say, trying to explain the difference between an old growth forest and a tree farm. And I say, well, tell you have a big area about three times the size of this school, so I give them something they can relate to. And I say, and in this forest, you have grandmothers and grandfathers, you have mommies and daddies, and you have uncles and aunts, and then you have big brothers and sisters, and then you have little babies. And the mommies and daddies and the grandmas and grandpas, because they're around, when the wind blows, they keep the little ones from blowing away. Then because when it rains all the time, and to keep the little ones from being flooded away and rained away, the big ones, they collect water and they absorb the water and then they release it gently to the little ones so the little ones can drink. And then the grandmas and grandpas, because they have to be at least 100 years old before they can grow this lichen. And this lichen, they have it fall down when the wind blows and it falls down on the ground. And then the little ones can eat it. They absorb it. And it's like vitamins It makes the roots grow strong and stabilize. And I said, but when you have now the difference between this huge family and a tree farm is that the trees don't just grow. The people come in and they put down all of these rows of trees. And they're all the same size. They're all the same age. It's like having the same area full of trees that are now all the same age. And they've been altered chemically. They're not exactly natural. And they don't have any mommies and daddies. And people come periodically and they poison them with herbicides and pesticides. And some of them die. A lot of them die. They're washed away. They're blown away. And by this time, the little kids are all saying, and the teacher's getting worried.
If somebody turned around tomorrow and said, Betty, you're in charge of Canada's forests, what would you do?
Immediately, I would call a meeting. I would call a meeting of all of the activists that I have known in the past. And then I would call people that I consider experts, but who have not necessarily been activists. I would call people like Sephora Berman and David Suzuki and Joe Foy and Ken Wu. But I would also call the people who have lived in the forest, who know the forest from different angles. I would call First Nations people who have not been what I consider too eager to make deals with the government. And there are quite a few of them who have protested the destruction of the forests. I would call the ones who are considered really radicals First Nations, and I know quite a few of those. And we would all sit down together, and we would not have one single government person there, because governments have gotten us into this, who are simply in bed with corporations. We will not have any corporations there. This is going to be a people's forum, because this is a people's forest. These forests belong to all of us, and they belong to First Nations, and they belong to people in general. And that we will come together with the First Nations people and say, okay, here, we're not going to have any industrial logging in British Columbia. That is out. There can be a certain amount of selected logging. Now, what are we going to do here? How is it? What areas do each of you think would be able to be logged in a selective manner that has not been already compromised by, been too compromised? We will save the pristine valleys, but we have to figure out what to do with the beetle kill. Yeah. This is a huge problem. It's bringing more carbon into the atmosphere than all of the rest of the trees and foliage is sinking, from what I understand. And let's get some real connection going here between activists and scientists and knowledgeable people who understand biosystems, but who also understand that we're going to have a different way of considering the resources of British Columbia, and they will not primarily be economic. They will be economic in the sense that a living can be made out of them, but not obscene amounts of money by a few people who steal everything away from the rest of us.
Coming up on future Green Chain podcasts, Adbuster-in-Chief Kali Lassen, Green Spirits Patrick Moore, and tree planting poet Charlotte Gill. For the Tai'i, I'm Mark Laren-Young.